Good morning, Dr. Ross Walker. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, mate. Lovely to talk to you.
As always, lovely to talk to you as well. Now, we've got a couple of listener questions. One comes from our discussion that I had with you last week. Where are my notes here? You said last week that it takes 5 years of taking fish or krill oil to basically reap the full benefits. John has sent an email in and he wants to know if that is the same for other supplements.
Oh, absolutely. You see, I see supplements as opposed to pharmaceuticals. To make this analogy, pharmaceuticals are like a high-performance motor car. Get you from A to B very quickly, but also with the potential of crashing and killing yourself. So you've got to have the seatbelts and the car safety protocols and all the stuff to keep you safe when you're driving, but you're going to get a good result quickly. Whereas I see pharmaceuticals like a bicycle, gets you from A to B much slower, but you get some exercise along the way and all you have to do is avoid cars running into you. So there's extra benefit, but it takes you a lot longer time to get to your destination. And it's the same thing with supplements, that really people that take supplements for a few months and say, I didn't feel any difference, so I stopped. That's not the reason to take supplements. They are called supplements for one reason, because they're supplements to a healthy lifestyle over a long period of time, not just over 2 or 3 or 4 years. You've got to take them for 5 years and beyond. And just to give you one really good example, there's a little known university in America called Harvard. And Harvard have been doing for the last 30 years the male physician's trial and the nurse's health study. There's about 180,000 people being followed in various guises, looking at all their health parameters, what drugs they take, what vitamins they take. And when they looked at the multivitamin component, those doctors who took a multivitamin for 10 years, up to 10 years, did absolutely nothing. But when they analysed the data at 10 years and beyond, there was about an 8% reduction in common cancers and cataracts just from taking a multivitamin every day. When they got to 15 years in the nurses, a 75% reduction in bowel cancer, a 25% reduction in breast cancer, 23% reduction in cardiovascular disease. When they'd got to 20 years in the male doctors, and how many anally retentive neurotics would take a multivitamin every day for 20 years? You're actually talking to one right now. That caused a 44% reduction in cardiovascular disease. So basically, if you're going to swallow supplements, you've got to be in it for the long haul.
All right, you've got to be in it for the long haul. But let me ask you this. What do you say when someone comes up to you and says, Dr. Ross, I don't know whether supplements are worth it or whether it's just expensive urine?
Yeah, well, people can say that. All I'm saying is when you look at the totality of evidence over a long period of time, there is an extra benefit. So just get back to what I was saying about a multivitamin. If you take it for 20 years, there's a 44% reduction in cardiovascular disease. Now, that's better than a statin. But the statins will give you a benefit within 2 or 3 years, whereas the multivitamin takes a lot longer. But mind you, when you look at lifestyle, changing your diet for a few weeks to months isn't going to make any difference at all. But when you look at the long-term effects of people who've had a good diet for their life, so for example, all the stuff in the Mediterranean diet, after about 5 years and beyond, we're seeing somewhere between a 30 to 50% reduction in all major diseases and in also improvement in all-cause mortality. And when you look at areas around the world that you and I have spoken about before on numerous occasions, like the blue zones, where they have extraordinary longevity, that's because of lifelong behaviours that are very, very healthy, not for something you do for a few months or a few years.
We've got a question from Robert here. Robert says, please ask Dr. Ross, after suffering a mini stroke some months ago, I am now taking 40 milligrams of blood pressure tablet, 140 milligram statin, 1 aspirin daily, also taking 80 milligrams of, is it Zanrubitin? I'll spell it Zanurubitin, and he says that's for CLL. So the question is from Robert, what could be causing the terrible bruising on my arms?
Well, it's probably the aspirin and the Zanrubitin together, but also you've got to say, why is he taking all this stuff? I just don't get it. You see, this is the problem when someone has a mini stroke. There's this ridiculous one-size-fits-all attitude where everyone gets a big dose of statin, blood pressure pill, low-dose aspirin and whatever other treatment they need for other conditions, which I have no problem with. But I've got a problem with this approach of just throwing this stuff at the blood pressure, the statin and the aspirin at everybody. Because here's the issue. Not all strokes are created equal. And what I'm saying by that, there are five different categories for stroke. So number one is what we call carotid atherosclerosis. You have a buildup of fat in the arteries going up to your brain. They're the people that need their cholesterol hammered, their blood pressure hammered, low-dose aspirin. Don't have a problem there. But a third of stroke is due to atrial fibrillation, where little clots form in the heart and flick up to the skull. It's got nothing to do with your cholesterol, but they still give people statins in this situation. And the aspirin's not good enough. They need to be on a much stronger blood thinner than aspirin, these newer drugs like Xarelto, Eliquis, or Pradaxa. So that's that part of it. Also, there's a thing called lacuna infarct where the blood pressure goes through the roof. It's got nothing to do with your cholesterol. What you need to do is have exquisite management of your blood pressure. Number four, you can have a tiny hole in your heart called a patent foramen ovale, and often that needs to be closed by a procedure through the vein in the groin. And then finally, some people have a tendency to blood thickening. So, for example, someone sits on a plane from Sydney to Heathrow in the economy section and comes out with a big swollen leg because they've clotted the veins in their leg. And they want to sue Qantas because they've got this clot in their leg. They should be suing their relatives who've given them the genetic screening, the genetic thickening abnormality in their bloodstream. So you can see that you can have a stroke. So a young woman goes on the oral contraceptive pill in their 20s and they have a stroke a month later. They want to sue Bayer. They, again, should be suing their relatives for giving them that genetic abnormality that thickened their blood. So it's just not a straightforward thing about saying, oh, I've had a stroke, therefore I need the biggest dose of statin I can take, good blood pressure pills, and low-dose aspirin. So, but the bruising is clearly from the aspirin. So he needs to go back to his GP and tell the GP that he's bruising and what should they do about it. And I'd like Robert to ask his treating doctors, what was the cause of his stroke? Which category was he in? Because you've got to treat the cause, not just give everyone this one-size-fits-all approach.
Okay, Ross Trevor wants to know, could you ask Dr. Walker if Sustagen is the same as multivitamins in effect?
Oh, not really, no, because Sustagen also has what we call macronutrients. So when you think about nutrition, there's the macronutrients, which is fat, sugar and protein, and that's what you are also getting in Sustagen. But there's also some micronutrients, which are vitamins, minerals, trace metals. And you don't get the same dose of the micronutrients in Sustagen that you would get in a standard multivitamin.
Some of the topics today, this is in reference to diabetes, or more to the point, pre-diabetes.
Yeah.
In a published editorial, a public health expert says that she believes that physicians should be more cautious when diagnosing someone with pre-diabetes because of the potential harm it can cause. Tell us more about this, Ross. In particular, what's the potential harm?
I think the potential harm is over-investigation and over-concern to someone. And I completely disagree with that. I think that what doctors should be to people are educators and servants. And what we have to do is give them proper education. Now, the commonest genetic abnormality in the world is insulin resistance. And insulin resistance occurs in 30% of Caucasians, 50% of Asians, and almost 100% of people with darker or olive skin. Now, if you're insulin resistant, that is the gene abnormality that then predisposes you to pre-diabetes and diabetes, to blood pressure, to a high triglyceride, low HDL, fat around the belly. So this is really the true pandemic of the 21st century. Is this metabolic syndrome that comes from having this insulin resistance gene. So I think it's really important to pick up people when they're pre-diabetic rather than allowing them to become diabetic. So I don't agree with this expert that's saying that we shouldn't be screening people. I think we should be screening people. But what screen should not be done is a thing called a glucose tolerance test, which as far as I'm concerned is 2 hours of your life you'll never get back. So basically you turn up and you turn up fasted in the morning to a pathology department. They give you this, take your blood and then give you this horrible tasting glucose preparation and then measure your blood a couple of times more to get sugar levels, sometimes insulin levels after all this. And it tells you nothing more about above having what's called a fasting blood sugar level and a fasting hemoglobin A1C. And from those levels, from the sugar level and the hemoglobin A1C, we can see whether you are pre-diabetic or actually a frank diabetic and do something about it. Now, the best thing anyone who is insulin resistant can do for their risk for pre-diabetes and diabetes is lose fat off their belly, which means eating less carbohydrates, refined carbohydrates, and processed packaged muck masquerading as food in something's in a box or a container, and just basically reducing their caloric intake. And another thing people don't think about here as well is that alcohol is full of empty calories. So people should work on that side of it. And when you want to lose weight and lose fat off the belly, it is 80% food, 20% exercise. So a lot of overweight people still go to the gym. You've got to lose that belly fat, and the best way is to cut back on the calories, the carbs, and the grog. So I think people should be screened for pre-diabetes and diabetes.
Ross, what are the symptoms of pre-diabetes?
So you don't have to have any symptoms, but there may be markers that you're on the way, such as increasing abdominal girth, such as your blood pressure going up, such as your triglycerides going up and your HDL going down. And they're not really symptoms. They're just features of pre-diabetes, insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome. All of these things all go together. So with diabetes, however, once you've got to the stage of your sugar levels going off the scale and your hemoglobin A1C going above what we call 6.5%, that's when you might start to get things like thirst and passing a lot of urine and feeling unbelievably tired, possibly even unexplained weight loss. Even though you put on all this weight, it might start to really start to pour off you because you've now become a diabetic and all the fluid's pouring out of your body.
Always feeling tired. I mean, there's other things that can be wrong with you, can't there, Ross, that is creating fact that you're always feeling tired?
Oh, yeah. And look, I say to people, as far as fatigue goes, there are five categories of fatigue and something else we need to mention. So let me just go through those briefly because I think they're very important for people to know. The commonest cause of fatigue that is really not a disease or a problem is you're working too hard, you're playing too hard, you're not sleeping well, so you're tired. That's no great shocks about that one. Probably the second commonest cause is sleep apnea. Now, Brent, you have sleep apnea. I have sleep apnea because we're males. All postmenopausal females have a degree of sleep apnea. But I can ask you one question about that, which will tell me how bad it is. When you wake up in the morning, do you feel refreshed or unrefreshed? So if you're waking unrefreshed and feeling pretty sleepy throughout the day and tired throughout the day, you probably have significant sleep apnea. That's number two. Number three is endogenous depression. Now, endogenous depression, still many people in the public don't understand what that is. They think, oh, look, I can't stand my partner, I hate my job, my kids are on drugs, I'm depressed. No, you're suffering grief. That is not chemical depression of the brain. Chemical depression of the brain is where the serotonin levels drop. So you look out the window, the birds are singing, and you say, who gives a? You don't care. You feel tired throughout the day. And typically you wake up at 2 a.m, staring at the ceiling for an hour, and you find it hard to get back to sleep. Number four, the fourth category, is when men and women get to around 50 or so, their hormones go south. So in women, obviously, it's called menopause. In men, it's called andropause. And that can be associated with marked tiredness. And the final category, before I get to the last thing, the final category is when people have a medical complaint or condition. So, for example, you might be on a statin drug to lower your cholesterol. 30% of people on statins feel a bit tired. There are a number of other medications that can make you tired. There are specific medical conditions that can make you tired. For example, you could be anemic. You could have a thyroid problem. You could have an iron deficiency. All of those things can make you tired. But equally, there could be something wrong with your kidneys, with your liver. And in fact, one of the major symptoms of a pending heart attack is unbelievable fatigue. So when you go through all of those five things, the final thing there is this rag bag of diagnoses that now is becoming much more accepted, which is chronic fatigue syndrome. And chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, even long COVID, are all under the same umbrella. And I think one of the common features there is gut dysbiosis, because your gut bacteria are pathogenic and you're not getting enough of the good stuff into your system. So that's a very quick summary of fatigue and how it happens.
Can I ask you about the waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning? You were talking about waking up at 2 o'clock in the morning and staring at the ceiling in reference to depression. Can it also be the fact that you're waking up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and you go to the bathroom, you come back to bed, and all of a sudden the mind starts to work? And if you've got a few problems, a few things that are causing you stress, it might be money's owed, it might be a problem at work, or it might be something like that, and you start to think about it, and you can't get back to sleep. That's not necessarily depression, is it?
No, not at all. Not at all. In fact, often with endogenous depression, there's nothing on your mind. You just can't sleep. So, yes, what you're talking about when you start to get anxious about things and say, oh, look, I should be doing this. So, you know, the monkey brain kicks in at nighttime when you're trying to sleep. That's a different thing altogether. So, but still, people with endogenous depression may do what you say, but equally they might just lie there and think, I just can't sleep. This is just doing my head in. That is a symptom of mild endogenous depression. It becomes severe, the endogenous depression, when you start to have a sense of hopelessness about your life, and tragically sometimes people do get suicidal thoughts. So if anyone's listening, please reach out to services that are there available to you to do something about it, because you don't. These things are absolutely treatable if you can get onto them early.
If you can't get back to sleep at 3 o'clock in the morning and you are thinking about problems, be it at home or at work, are you best to lie there and toss and turn and toss and turn, or actually get up and get out of bed and do something to take your mind off?
Yeah, you're best to get up and get out of bed and sit quietly by yourself, maybe reading a very gentle book. Don't read a thriller, but just read a gentle book, or do something that's different to just lying there. It's the worst thing you can do, because you're not going to get back to sleep if you just lie there and think and think and think. Get out, do something else. Go and make yourself a drink of chamomile tea, something that doesn't have caffeine in it, which may also help you get back off to sleep. Don't get out of bed and go and eat stuff. It's very, very bad for you to eat in the middle of the night.
Let's talk pomegranates. Researchers say that pomegranates could offer a solution to fatty liver disease. Blokes probably over the age of 50 that don't have a sufficient diet, you know, eat enough vegetables and fruit and all those sort of things, and have too much meat, maybe too many carbs, maybe too many glasses of wine. It's nothing to go to the doctor and he said, look, you've got fatty liver disease.
Oh, mate, it's not just that. The problem is, 2015, 25% of the adult population were diagnosed with fatty liver disease. 2021, it had gone up to 29%. Fatty liver disease is very much associated with the insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome, pre-diabetes, we're talking about as well. So if you've got fat in the belly, you can often have fat in the liver as well. In fact, there are some people who don't appear to have much in the way of abdominal fat who still have fatty liver disease. And the reality is there's not much we can do for fatty liver at this stage. Now, let me say, however, that I published with my colleagues in Italy a paper in the Journal of Clinical Lipidology a few years ago showing that the bergamot products that I've been talking about for years do have a beneficial effect in reducing fatty liver disease. But this paper done at the Edith Cowan University in Perth showed that there's a compound called ellagic acid, which is present especially in pomegranates, in raspberries, in blueberries, in pecan nuts, have been shown to significantly reverse fatty liver disease as well. So we're talking about some very good natural products that can help reduce fatty liver disease, because there are no medical therapies that appear to be effective apart from something you and I have spoken a bit about in the last year or so, the wonder drug Ozempic and all of its spin-offs, because the Ozempic takes fat out of every part of the body, not just out of the abdominal fat, but also takes fat out of the heart. A lot of work to show that Ozempic and its friends can reduce heart disease risk by about 20%, potential for some cancer reduction as well. So I suspect we'll find out that Ozempic works for fatty liver disease. But let's face it, if you can take natural stuff and it works, it's so much better for you.
So have a glass of pomegranate juice every day.
Oh, absolutely. And pomegranate juice is also extremely good for your blood pressure.
Now, flu-monia, it's something I've never heard of before, but there's so many flus and bugs around at the moment. Apparently, Ross, there's now this thing called flu-monia. What's that?
Yeah. Well, flu-monia is just the term that's been given to this viral soup that we've had really emerge around Australia in just in the last week or so in New South Wales. the rates of the big five, apart from one, which I'll talk about, have gone through the roof. So, for example, there's this thing you may have heard of called walking pneumonia, which is really just a Reader's Digest term for a bug called mycoplasma pneumonia. And so people, they call it walking pneumonia because you're not dreadfully ill with it. You can still walk around, but you've got a cough and you're short of breath. And mycoplasma pneumonia is a bacterial illness caused by this atypical bacteria, Mycoplasma pneumoniae, and it can be treated with antibiotics. So that's where that one works, but we're seeing a marked increase in this mycoplasma pneumonia. Then there's also standard influenza. So there's been a 30% increase in the last week in reported influenza cases. So when we say reported cases, there are many cases that are not reported. So you can imagine how much influenza there is around at the moment. When they're still rearing its ugly head is good old COVID, which I had personally 2 weeks ago, and a lot of my friends have had this latest variant of COVID. Knocked us around for a few days, but we're all getting better from it. And then there's whooping cough. Now, you wouldn't think whooping cough would be going nuts, but it's quadrupled in the last 4 months. So whooping cough's a big issue. And unfortunately, because there's still that branch of anti-vaxxers out there that are making out that vaccinations the worst thing that's happened to the world, people not being vaccinated for whooping cough, even little kids are getting it, and it can be lethal in children. And then finally, the only thing that isn't going through the roof is this respiratory syncytial virus, RSV, which is starting to drop off a bit. You can be vaccinated against RSV. It's pretty expensive, not covered by the PBS, but it is there for people who are very vulnerable to things like this, little children. It's certainly adults over the age of 70 especially.
I was talking to someone only today, and they were going to get some blood tests, and they were saying they were sitting in the waiting room, and the girl on the phone was asking people if they've had the latest COVID vaccination in reference to being able to come into the surgery.
Yeah, no, well, I think that's going a bit over the top, but there are still a lot of general practices, and you've got to feel for the general practices because they're the ones that get exposed to people who are very ill. So in my practice as a cardiologist, people don't come in because they're sick. They say, oh, no, I'm sick, I can't come in today, doctor, which is fine, but I don't get exposed to that sort of viral soup as much as these other people do. I got my COVID. We went out to dinner with friends of ours a couple of weeks ago, and she texted us the next day and said, I've just tested positive for COVID. Oh, thanks for that.
I hope you enjoyed your dinner.
Yeah, it was a lovely dinner until the next day.
As always, we enjoy our chat with you. Thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Good on you, mate. Lovely to talk to you. Talk to you next week.